This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today we are broadcasting a conversation with John Huntsman Jr. on his career as a businessman, ambassador, governor, advisor, and diplomat. The discussion focuses on Huntsman's experience as an ambassador to China and Russia, what role Utah plays in a globalized world, and how public service has shaped his career and outlook on domestic and international politics. Interviewing Ambassador Huntsman is Annie Marie Barnes, student body president of the Associated Students of the University of Utah. This forum was recorded on December 5th, 2019. Here is student body president Annie Marie Barnes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, John, for joining us today. And he told him that I could call him John.
And your choice, it was either that or your holiness.
Well, either or, really. Same thing, right? So thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for the introduction, Abby. As Abby mentioned, you have an extensive career in public service. And I think to start off, I'd just like to ask, how did you get that start? And what was the motivation for wanting to be in public service?
Well, first of all, it's a great pleasure to be here at the Hinckley Institute with friends and with family, with Mary Kay and with my sister, Christina, and some other family members. And Dave is here. It's just an honor to be here. When I was a student here, I was afraid to attend these. Seriously.
Is there a reason why?
Oh, yeah. I was intimidated by the thought that I'd have to ask a question. And I look back and I'm grateful to people who aren't here anymore. And I thank them. When I was a graduation speaker here at the university a few years ago, I thank Sandra Taylor, who's not around anymore, for teaching a class on the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War, which I'd never heard before. And I'm grateful to John Dong, who taught me advanced Chinese, because he gave me a lift and a start in a language that I had studied, but not to that level. And I'm grateful. And I'm grateful to Roger Reber, who was a professor here of long standing, who taught me international relations. And his lectures went on and on. And he gave me a book by Hartman, which was, of course, the textbook of all textbooks for the intro to international relations. And I had never read anything like that before. And it stimulated me and it turned me on to the world right here, right, like it's doing to all of you. And I'm also grateful to a couple of other professors who I totally disagreed with because they were not my political stripe. But you know what? I sat through their lectures and I was dumbfounded because I had never heard what they were preaching. They gave me books by Michael Parenti and C. Wright Mills. And I'd never read stuff like that before, and I did. And it opened my mind to a lot of things that I otherwise would never have consumed. And so stuff I agreed with, stuff I disagreed with, people who inspired me, and they turn on a switch, and they make it so that you have more confidence when you're coming through the door, and you can sit, and you can participate in the give and take, and you can ask questions. And I have to say that but for a few folks who really turned me on to some subjects, you don't go anywhere. But it's also the one rate limiting factor that we all have, and that's fear. Because you're all thinking about where you want to go, what your career wants to be, what you want to study, what kind of relationships you want to have. If you take the fear factor out of life, what would we be doing? Would it be different than what we're doing now? Because we're all afraid of failure. We're all afraid to do stuff that might embarrass us, like running for office. The ultimate form of public humiliation. So are there any veterans in the audience? Are there any teachers in the audience? Where? Thank you. Thank you. Teachers in the audience. Thank you. Teachers in the audience, aspiring teachers? Are there any Foreign Service officers in the making? Come on, folks. So I say that because you can forget everything else I say today, but I want you to remember one thing. I want you to remember service. Because at the end of the day, our community and our country is only as good as you and your willingness to give back and to do something that sometimes might require a risk. And at first blush, your answer is, no, I'm not going to do that because I'm afraid. I don't want to fail. I don't want to make a fool of myself. Dismiss that thinking and go for it. Take a risk. Because you're going to get toward the end of life and say, woulda, coulda, shoulda. Why didn't I do that? So forget everything else I say when you walk out of the room here. That's all I want you to remember.
All right. Well, I guess we're done with the questions then. No, I'm just kidding. Thank you for
sharing.
Class
dismissed.
I think that's very profound. And I think the idea of taking risks and being open to failure is very profound. And it kind of leads me into what I want to ask you about next. So you've most recently served in China and Russia, two countries that have a very challenging relationship with the United States for many years, but especially right now. What are the most significant challenges you feel that the United States has in relation to those two powers? And where do you think that Utah fits into those challenges and how it can be evaded?
The hardest decision I made in recent years was accepting an offer by the President of the United States, not of my political party, when I was governor. The hardest thing I ever did. Because on one hand, how do you turn down a president? You don't, at least that's not the way I was raised. And on the other hand, how do you tell a state that you're leaving to assume some national responsibility? So as I go around and, you know, get to see people, some folks will say, well, you left. Well, yeah, I went on to serve. I did. Governor Mike Leavitt went on to serve. Governor Dern went on to serve as Secretary of War under FDR in World War II when he was governor. You move on and you do things, and it's really tough, but you do that, and I have a hard time saying no, but that's public service, and that's federal service, and I've done that. So here's how you should package up the world. So you can't live in Beijing, and you can't live in Moscow without concluding a couple of things. Number one is we're rapidly going from what was a bipolar world when I was sitting where you are, to more of a unipolar world some years thereafter, and now multipolarity is sort of breaking out. There are a lot of poles of influence in the world, and there is one superpower, that would be the United States. Now, so why are we the only superpower in the world? Because our economy is the strongest by far, and it's not just in sheer output terms, because China's about where we are, $20, $21 trillion in output. But it's because we have an innovative capacity to invent things that isn't the case in China right now. And I don't know if it ever will be, because culturally there are some challenges. We are a country with a strong military. We spend $550 to $600 billion per year on an outstanding military. I have two sons who are serving active duty now. Russia spends about $65 billion per year, as against our 600 to 650, and the Chinese spend about $150 billion a year. Our largest line item within the military budget is healthcare spending. You don't often think in those terms. It's usually weapon systems, you would think, but it's healthcare for the troops. But the most important thing we have that nobody else really does have is an ability to create a self-sustaining civil society, like you were talking about earlier, what you want to do in your career. No one else, so far as I can tell, in our range of powerful countries has the ability for an individual to go out on their own to create a movement, civil society, something organized around their passion or what they care about, and to build it and to sustain it and to have it influence the body politic. You can't do that in Russia. We couldn't do this in Russia. They wouldn't ever let me speak at a university in Russia. I asked repeatedly. Not Moscow University, Leningrad University. I got to go once to their foreign affairs training academy where a lot of young people your ages who were going into the Russian Foreign Service or the intelligence services, and I spent time with them. But otherwise, it was yet. Because they didn't want to hear ideas. And China the same. for the most part, although I did get around to some universities in China. But we have that unique ability to create civil society, which is something altogether unique to the United States. So that should never be forgotten. So superpower, and then we have two great powers in the world. And that would be China, and that would be Russia. China, because of its trend toward superpower status, eventually, its strong economy, its geographic location next to major markets, its manufacturing capacity, and increasingly its military. It's able to sail a whitewater fleet with accuracy and duration, which they couldn't do before. Russia is a great power. And listen, working with the Russian people, they are beautiful and they are brilliant and they are talented, 150 million of them. And they live in the largest expanse of land in the world, 11 time zones, from Kaliningrad to Vladivostok and everything in between. They're very special people, I have to tell you. A little cold on the outside, but once you break that veneer, they are friends for life. And I saw it over and over again, and so did Mary Kay. They are a great power, not because their economy is in the range of China's or the United States. Their economy is only $1.5 trillion in output per year, roughly the size of Texas, or a province within China. Small. But they have nuclear weapons. They have as many nuclear weapons as we do. And the ability to deliver those weapons with great precision to targets from airplanes, from submarines, and from land-based systems, including road mobile systems. So that makes them a great power. And what you walk away from those relationships understanding is that the challenge for the United States is going to be, how do we maintain our sanity with powers bumping up against us? So they call it the Thucydides trap. So you can take it all the way back to Athens and Sparta and the wars back in those days. When there's a rising power that bumps up into an existing order, in this case led by the United States, oftentimes war breaks out. That's the result of a shifting dynamic in world power and world order. Well, we have a power in China bumping up against the United States. So the question for us will be, can we coexist in a world with competing forces that are able to project economic power and military power almost to the point where we can? And we have never lived in a world like that. I mean, the Soviet Union, when they were at their peak before its fall in 91, was somewhat like that, but we've never seen a China on the world stage in terms of its ability to do what it does. So that'll be the big challenge before us, and it's out there. And we all have to understand the world and the dynamics of the world and the shifting world and figure out how we're going to maintain our equilibrium and sanity as we go forward to ensure that war doesn't break out, because war would be cataclysmic in that kind of situation. So that's just a thought that I walk away with from both.
So if I can ask you a follow-up to that, beyond what you've discussed in terms of the ability for the United States to create a civil society and individuals being empowered to do so, what do you think also makes us competitive to meet those challenges?
You know, we have great universities. If you want to know what one of the envies of the world is about the United States, it's our research universities. So what would China like to see more of? They'd like to see more research universities, and they're trying to build them. So if you break it down to a higher ed institution per million population, which is generally what we do here in the United States, so for every million people, you have a major research university. The Russians outdo us by two or three fold. So they have a lot of great institutions of higher learning, but they don't have a lot of research universities that create intellectual property that in the laboratories and that translate the intellectual property to the marketplace. So that's what this university does. And it's pretty awesome to see, you know, how it germinates in the great minds that in the laboratories, you know, the PhD scientists and others create things, and then off it goes to the marketplace. And it creates Wambo, another Apple or another Google or another end of the Human Genome Project or something. That's not the case in other countries. And that's something that we have too that I think really bodes well for our long-term competitive advantage.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Glad I'm getting a degree then. So kind of to switch gears, of course the impeachment proceedings have been happening, and over the course of those, regular citizens have had the opportunity to take a look more closely at the role of diplomats and the role of ambassadors. And how do you think that the dialogue and the proceedings have impacted that profession, positively, negatively, overall?
I'm proud of our diplomats. I've worked with them for years. I consider myself one. And it actually translates very well to work as governor, because as governor, what does a governor do? A governor leads. That's what they pay you to do. They pay you to lead and look around the bend to anticipate risk for the people who elected you to that office. And in order to do that properly, you have to build coalitions. You got to bring people together from all ideological points of view to the table and, you know, look at the best ideas and the best solutions going forward. And that's what diplomats do. And it's always been, you know, a mystery to me why, you know, we have more musicians in the Defense Department marching bands than we have diplomats in the United States. So get your head around that. So if our first line of preemption against war is our ability to negotiate solutions to problems, then it probably would behoove us to have a few more diplomats and well-trained diplomats who are there on the front lines, ensuring that we don't go to war. So I tell my sons, who are both in the Navy, I hope I do my job well, so it will keep you from having to go to war. That's the way the system works. So I'm proud of our diplomats, and I know very well those who have appeared before the hearings over the last couple of weeks. They're my friends and colleagues, including those in the National Security Council staff. And I have high regard for what they do, and what they do is to tell the truth. And that's why we rely on them, because their function is primarily to report on events that are happening in the countries to which they're posted. Those reports inform policy and create the history of the United States. And so they're trained to do that, and they're trained to keep a keen eye and a keen ear open to events and to just, whether a Republican or a Democrat, just to straight up do their work. And that's been a great tradition of the Foreign Service ever since Benjamin Franklin was our first diplomat. And Thomas Jefferson allegedly asked Benjamin Franklin, would you like, this is after the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, would you like to be a soldier or a diplomat for your country? And Benjamin Franklin said, well, I think I'd rather lie for my country than die for my country. So he became a diplomat.
That's John Huntsman Jr., former Utah governor and U.S. ambassador. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety as a public service. Today we are airing a conversation with John Huntsman Jr. on his long career in public service, from Utah to the White House to the ambassadorships of Russia and China. Here again is ASUU Student Body President Annie Marie Barnes.
Thank you. So within your scope of public service abroad, I'm sure that you've been able to be exposed to a lot of things and learn a lot of things. And I'm wondering if your philosophy in terms of diplomacy and foreign relations has changed over the course of your service and how.
What has influenced me, impacted me, is how it impacts us right here at home. So what drives me to want to do something as crazy as to run again for governor? Well, love for the state, commitment to service. We'll be around for the long term, and you want to see the state the very best it can be. But you begin to see how small the world is getting. You begin to see that we are no longer competing against Colorado, Arizona, Nevada, California. We're competing against Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea, Luxembourg, Ireland, UK. And it is a global marketplace. And for those who say otherwise, they're smoking something they made legal in Colorado. Because you've got countries, not states, but you've got countries that are trying to take our jobs and divert investment away from our marketplace to theirs, trying to take students from us to their universities. It's very, very competitive. So you can't walk out of today's diplomatic world without concluding and understanding that, okay, the most precious thing we have in this country is the vote, our ability to elect people, the integrity of the voting box. And when you have a country like Russia that now is able to penetrate and jeopardize the integrity of our election process, that's a huge problem. So for me, as I look at the implications right here locally, and I think this was made public not so long ago in terms of Russia's ability to infiltrate several states. They didn't do anything, but it suggested that they have the ability to manipulate the outcome of elections. My goodness, you know. So what if, you know, a local election in one of our 29 counties or one of our cities was manipulated to where it just reversed the outcome? That would cause complete havoc and a diminution in trust in our democratic processes. That's what is the reality of today's world that really didn't exist before. So are we prepared for that? I don't think so. To see what a country, the capability it has to probe, to change, to manipulate, to sow seeds of doubt and discontent and confusion is very real. The Twitter sphere, Facebook, might surprise all of you to hear that, you know, there are troll farms up in St. Petersburg that are putting up cutout stories, fake accounts are being created, and they are playing on many of our most sensitive debates in this country, on race and guns. And they're dividing us. And we think it's Americans doing this, speaking. Guess again. And why are they doing it? Because a divided America is better for them. We're not at our best. We're less powerful, and when we don't like each other, and we're arguing and throwing stuff across the room, that's just fine with them. But it's not so good for us. So that's a big problem. But you also have to conclude right here locally that without a hyper-competitive economy that is addressing the job needs, not just what we have, but looking around the bend, the jobs of tomorrow. And quite frankly, how you get them more out into the rural areas where not all counties are prosperous in the state. I was just in one yesterday and then in one the day before where they want more opportunity, and we need to figure that one out. If we don't, there are a lot of other players out there who would like to take those jobs and take that opportunity. So it comes right back to home base.
Thank you very much. And something you mentioned, foreign interference in our elections, and whether that's more disguised via trolling or it's more direct via manipulating election numbers and vote counts and things like that. How can we protect our democracy and take back the narrative?
This is what we all need to work on. You know, is it back to paper ballots? Who knows?
The hanging but, Chad.
Yeah, exactly. We've been through this before. First, we have to recognize it and not be dumb to what's happening out there, not be naive. And then we have to make sure that the processes, the technologies that we have in place that get people out to vote, that register people to vote, have the right countermeasures so that we can ward off any kinds of attacks that would change the dates of voter registration to confuse people. I mean, there are little things that realistically could happen that would really sow seeds of doubt in our ability to manage a healthy democracy. Be aware of it. Work with the federal government, namely Homeland Security, on what is being used against us and the best countermeasures that we can use basically to protect ourselves.
Thank you. So considering all of your experience and all of the opportunities you've had globally, what opportunities encouraged you to want to return to Utah?
Well, Utah's home. And it has been since 1973, since our family moved here. You know, the Huntsmans were pretty much run out of Utah back in the day. But we find our way here. This is home, and it always will be. And we're going to be working on a better Utah, whether I'm in politics or not. That's just what we do. So it's family, it's roots, it's home. But you also can't help but see that, particularly living in places like Beijing and Moscow, that we have some incredible assets here that don't exist anywhere else. And if they're nurtured and built upon, we could be ahead in the game in terms of quality of life, which is what, listen, what do people want? They want life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness in an area that they like to live in, with friends and family that they enjoy being with. And that includes opportunity. Well, that's not a given everywhere. We're going to have to work hard to make sure that we maintain that here. But it's, so you look at the challenges on the horizon that, you know, could impact that, and this is all part of, you know, the interest that drove us to move in this direction, is the simple task of dealing with the next million people who come into the state over the next decade. So what do we do? You know, when Salt Lake County has 40,000 acres left that's undeveloped, that's all. And Utah County might have two or three times that, but you look at Weber and Davis, and they don't have a whole lot of land left. So essentially, the Wasatch Front is spoken for from a development standpoint. You look at air. Anyone check the air quality today? So what is it?
Bad.
Yes, it's bad. Anyone know how bad?
Yep.
AQI index.
4.3, PM 2.5.
PM 2.5 is?
4.3.
50, so PM 2.5 above 50 is in the red zone.
No, it's orange.
Orange.
One more point
of worry. And you're red. Okay, it's borderline. And what is the AQI today? It's probably 120, 125. So when was the last time we had an AQI reading above 120 in the state? Anybody know?
Yesterday.
Nope. Close. It's great because the Department of Air Quality puts up information, and I love looking at this stuff. So I checked it out, you know, as I kind of do every morning. Because when you live in Beijing, you learn to check air quality every day. Every day. So I checked it out today. And so Mexico's at 500. Moldova's at 3. We are at 122. We're right between Iraq and Germany is where it falls in terms of air quality. And it's the worst on record for the year is what it is. So what do we do? What about water? So if our weather patterns begin producing more rain in the north instead of snow. The rain is not capturable. It absorbs. And snow we can capture into reservoirs, which we probably need one or two more of. So that's a problem in a very dry, thirsty state where our water needs are going to go up and up, even though per capita consumption has gone down, you know, from maybe 350 gallons a day to 200 gallons a day. But I was just out in Tooele meeting with the county commissioners just on the other side of the Okers. Number one issue for them, water. They don't have any water. So how can you develop an economy without water? How can you accommodate the growth that's happening in their county without water? So these are all part of when you look here and you see all of the great things we have going for us. Well, if we stay ahead of the growth curve, we can maintain our position. If we fall behind, anyone from Maricopa County? Anyone from Clark County? Anyone from L.A. County? You know what I'm talking about then. You know, when you lose control of growth, sometimes it's really hard to catch up. And we're right now kind of at the borderline of maintaining our ability to control growth. But once we lose that control, I don't think you ever gain it back. And that's when your quality of life goes right down. And that's where your competitive edge then becomes jeopardized. Because with the airport closed yesterday, how many flights were diverted yesterday? Dozens. So when people try to come in to find a job in Lehigh, at one of those great high-tech startup companies, but the plane can't land, and they take a look at the air quality, they say, I think I'll take the job in Austin, Texas. And that we can't let that happen. That then impacts our long-term competitiveness, which goes right back into what we discussed earlier, that then you can't pay the bills.
Yes, thank you. And then just one last question before we open it up to some students. But I'm curious, with the problems that you mentioned locally, the things that we have to tackle federally, and just the sheer amount of issues that students face on a normal basis, finances, mental health, completing assignments, personal and family relationships. Why is it important for students at the University of Utah to take time to care about global issues, to reflect on them, and to work and mobilize to better them?
I love that question, because I hope everyone here in this room really understands the importance of that question, because it's all of you. Because in a few short years, you'll be sitting up here, and you'll be in the driver's seat, and you'll be trying to figure out the issues of the day. I hope that's where you are. And I hope that you find some way to get involved in a campaign this next coming year, 2020. Doesn't have to be mine. If it is, that'd be great. I'd love to have you. Find somebody. Find an issue that drives your passion and get involved. Because if you don't, that's inexcusable. Totally, totally inexcusable. We send people off to war to protect a system that some people just then take advantage of, and that's totally unacceptable. So the world's going to be in your hands, and because of what, you know, some of the things we've talked about here, the world is a small place, and local events are felt globally, and global events impact us right here at home. So you need to understand your world. You need to figure out how world events impact your life, because they do with lightning speed. That's just where we are today, and you can do something about it. So that's mighty important. And I'm glad you brought up mental health as well, because one of the issues that I'm going to get out and talk about, that I've already talked about, we've been to almost every college campus, university college campus in the state, is mental health, because the state has had a collective failure when it comes to mental health, and everybody knows it, and nobody wants to talk about it. And here we are. Nobody knows what to do. Our indicators are off the charts. We need a clarion call. And listen, the governor can't solve all these things, but the governor has convening power that can bring people to the table who need to be there to solve the problem. And it's going to be faith-based organizations, it's going to be local state governments, is going to be foundations, corporations, volunteers, healthcare providers, et cetera, et cetera. They all need to be part of it. Because I'll be darned if we're going to keep looking at these statistics that we have been reading about into the future. That's just totally unacceptable. So we're going to talk about that, and maybe I'll get kicked out as a candidate for doing that. But I think that's important. I really do. And that's going to be one of the things that we discuss. And I hope that you all take it up as well, because it's going to need your generation. And you all know what I'm talking about, because the 18 to 24 demographic is at risk, probably the most at risk. And you read about levels of anxiety, particularly among college kids. I don't think I could be a college student today. The pressures you feel, the friendships that you have to maintain, the likes and unlikes on iPhones all day long, I don't know how you do it. The anxiety around finals, you carry a lot of a real emotional load, and I commend you for it, because it's a different environment than the one I grew up in. But because of that, it manifests itself in certain behaviors that sometimes are not healthy, and so we have to demystify mental health so that people can talk normally about it, as if they do a hip replacement, and they can walk into a mental health facility without thinking that it's a dark place that where they have to hide. We just have to demystify. It can be done, no doubt about it, and everyone will be better off because of it. I guarantee you.
That's John Huntsman Jr., former Utah governor and U.S. ambassador. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, former Utah Governor and Ambassador John Huntsman Jr. takes questions from the audience of faculty and students.
Thank you so much for answering a few of my questions, and we'd love to open it up to the audience now for some student questions. And I think Abby will be coming around with the mic.
So if you want to ask a question, just raise your hand and make sure you talk into the mic, and we'll be doing student questions first.
Yes.
So if there's any students that want to ask a question.
Hi. You spoke about leadership. That's something that really kind of interests me. In your own words, what makes a good leader, and how can young people work on becoming leaders?
First of all, tell me your name and where you're from and what you're studying.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name's Eric. I'm from Holiday, Utah.
And what are you studying?
Mass communications and journalism.
Good for you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Eric, because journalists are not the enemy of the people. They're an essential part of our system, and may that always be the case. I'm not an expert in the field of leadership. You have to play that role when you lead organizations. So you try some things that work and some things that don't work. But I think by and large, you can't be a leader unless you inspire others by, first of all, listening. Because we've got two ears and one mouth. And a lot of politicians forget that ratio. And they speak too much and listen too little. And a good leader listens first. And a good leader eradicates boundaries and makes people feel respected, regardless of their point of view. So it's hard to run a big, complicated embassy or a big, complicated state without eradicating lines of division. Because everybody walks into a room and sits at a table, whether it's a country team at the embassy where you've got military, intelligence, diplomats, 30 other agencies represented. And everybody has a different point, and you have to lead them. And there are always going to be lines of division or disagreements, and you've got to pull people together around a singular goal. So I would also say that leaders are good goal keepers, not in the soccer sense, but they're able to create goals and destinations for a team and then drive the team in that direction. So without distinct goals, without desired outcomes, leaders just sort of spin. So that's something that I think is important in a leader. But you'll never get anywhere as a leader without respecting people around you and their points of view. That's kind of where it all starts. And how do you get there? You listen a lot. Good luck to you. What do you want to do?
I don't know. I'm a little bit directionless.
Dream big. Dream big. Go for it. No fear.
Hi, I'm Jack. I'm studying political science and business economics.
Hey, Jack.
And I'm just wondering, you've worked closely with the Russian government, and what do you see as the future of Russia kind of in a post-Putin leadership world?
And where are you going, Jack? What's your big picture out there?
I don't know.
With a question like that, how about the Foreign Service? So Putin has been, I guess I probably spent as much time with and around Vladimir Putin than most any other American. And he's an interesting man. He's a patriot. He loves his country. He fights for his country. He's got a bag of tricks that he uses in pursuit of his objectives that are sometimes dangerous. And we've been on the receiving end of some of those. He's now been in office for 20 years. It's important to note that the Russian state is an extension of Putin. So the prevailing orthodoxy is not Marxism-Leninism, but it's Putinism. And Putin, after he graduated law from Leningrad University, went into the KGB, where he served for about 17 years and rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel. He was an average intelligence officer. He was not outstanding, nor was he an outstanding student. But he was swept up into the events of 1991 with the collapse of empire, when the Soviet Union was thrown into the trash heap of history. And he went to work for Mayor Sobchak, who was then a reform mayor in St. Petersburg, and ran the Office of Economic Development. Strange where an intelligence officer would end up doing that. And from there, he went to Moscow, where he joined his intelligence colleagues and became the head of the FSB, which was the successor to the KGB, and also, for a brief period, the head of the Security Council. Then he was made prime minister for a while, and president by Boris Yeltsin. Now, why was he made president? Nobody had ever heard of him before, outside of a small circle of national security professionals. Because Boris Yeltsin needed someone to protect him and his family. It's the way the system works. So who better than somebody who runs the security services to get that done? So he came into power 20 years ago, and he's outlived every leader on the world stage. He's worked with them all. He's seen them all. He knows every trick in the book. He's at the negotiating table. He's soft-spoken. You can almost barely hear what he's saying. 5'7". He's not an imposing figure. But he has method to the madness. He knows where his discussions are going. He knows how to get what he wants from the person on the other side of the table because he's been doing it for so long. He knows every trick of the book. He constitutionally is out of office in 2024. So the next few years are going to be really interesting because there's no successor. Nobody. So what do you do when you're sitting in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, among other things? You try to figure out what the next group of leaders is going to be. And so, you know, you spend a lot of time trying to sort through the oblast governors and intelligence leaders and military leaders, Duma leaders, to try to figure out who's rising. And I'll be darned if, you know, I couldn't tell you who the next Vladimir Putin will be. I don't think anybody knows, which is a huge danger. And it's part of his operating style. He doesn't want anyone to know. I'm not sure that he knows. So the years ahead are going to be really interesting because there's going to be a lot of infighting within the system over who succeeds Putin. And whether or not the post-2024 period will continue as it is today under Putinism, I don't think that it will. When you have 25,000 people turn out in the streets by Sakhalin Square, they don't do that in China, by the way. But they do, it's part of the constitution, the Russian constitution. People are able to turn out and protest, and they do until the security services tell them the day is over. There's something happening in Russia that's quite interesting. And people are asking the question, what does it mean to be Russian? What is in it for me? I know what's in it for the oligarchs, but what's in it for me? There's no civil society. There's no ability to petition my government. There's no freedom in the strictest sense. So keep an eye on the run-up to 2024, because I think we're in for a really interesting period. And what we do know is that when Russia goes through a transformational change, as it did in 1917 during the Bolshevik Revolution, it was violent, and it produced a completely different outcome. The same thing happened in 1991, when there was the end of empire and the rise of the Russian Federation. Less violent, but it was an amazing change that occurred in 3 days. People don't stop to think about that. The whole Soviet Union ended in 3 days, and the rise of the Russian Federation, completely different system that didn't last long before Putin took over. So, you know, is 2024 going to be a similar kind of phenomenon where there are seismic shifts that occur? Somebody completely different than Putin? I don't think anyone has the answer for that, but I can tell you that the years ahead are going to be very, very interesting.
My name's Atticus. I'm studying philosophy and military science here at the U. I'm just wondering, because I think you're kind of in a unique position, if you have any commentary as to how regular civilians in the U.S. and maybe how the U.S. itself can respond to the situation in Hong Kong right now, given your experience.
And tell me what you're studying.
Philosophy and military science.
Nice. And so what? Where will that take you?
Law school and hopefully ethics consulting for...
Good for you. Thanks for doing that.
Yeah.
More people need to think about that. The Hong Kong thing. Well, first of all, I think we all need to recognize that Hong Kong is not mainland China in the strictest sense. The people of Hong Kong have been under a different form of government and a different culture for 150 years. Ever since Hong Kong was given to the British as a concession after the Opium Wars of 1840, 1842. And so, you know, my friends in Hong Kong, they were raised with rule of law, civil society, kind of a directly elected LegCo, the Legislative Council that runs Hong Kong. And they're making improvements on that even now. So then you factor in what happened in 1997 when Margaret Thatcher and Deng Xiaoping signed the agreement after the deal with the British concluded that Hong Kong would be turned over to the People's Republic of China, and for 50 years it would basically maintain its same standard of civil society, freedom, self-determination. Well, it appears as though Beijing is looking differently at Hong Kong. And exerting themselves in ways that I think a lot of people are a little concerned by, a lot concerned by, including the extradition agreement that inflamed a lot of this to begin with. So when you have 1/5 of your population, so Hong Kong's what, 6 million people, 7 million people, 1/5 of your population turning out in the streets, that's not a good day. And when they continue doing it for the better part of a year, that's even worse. And Xi Jinping doesn't have a whole lot of options because he can't take a heavy hand against Hong Kong, heavier than he has, because we all remember what happened after June 4th of 1989, Tiananmen Square. It ruined the Chinese economy for a long, long time. And I think there's great concern about that. So Xi Jinping, who runs the country of China, he looks at Hong Kong a little differently because his dad, Xi Zhongcun, used to be the primary liaison person with Hong Kong back in the 1960s, when the United States and the UK were running operations through Hong Kong into China. So Xi Jinping, growing up, did not hear favorable things about Hong Kong. Moreover, Xi Jinping also ran the provinces of Fujian and Zhejiang, and then he was a party secretary in Shanghai. These are all major competitors of Hong Kong for jobs and investment. So in the head of Xi Jinping, he doesn't look favorably at Hong Kong, in my estimation. So is it going to stop? No, I don't think it ends anytime soon. I think it continues, simply because you've got a clash of cultures and a clash of values playing out. What can you do? We can watch and we can learn. And you can support in any way that a free society would want to support another free society. Thank you for that.
Hi, my name is Charlie. I'm a freshman here. I'm studying psychology and criminology, and thanks, I'm a Charlie. Marine option in the Naval ROTC department. Earlier, you talked about war and you know, who our competitors were as far as being a world power. If we go to war, when do you think that'll be? Why? And what do you think that will look like?
Boy, that's an impossible question. But so, you're Naval ROTC. What are you going to do when you graduate?
Be a Marine Corps officer.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. I was born in the Navy. So my mom still complains about $25 she had to spend on the berth, on the GI Bill. Some said, "Well, you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth." No, born on the GI Bill. Great company came later. You know, it's hard to predict these things, but every country has tripwires and red lines, and you're going to learn this in your Navy strategy classes. You know, so it's important to understand what the red lines of the United States are and what the red lines of China are. So who conceivably could we go to war with these days? There are probably 4 or 5 countries that we could find ourselves at war with. I don't think that will happen because the price of war is too high, and I think the red lines with China, which would be a calamity if we ever went to war with China, we should be engaging and figuring out ways of solving our problems with China, not figuring out how to go to war. But you have red lines like the South China Sea, like Taiwan, like Tibet, like Xinjiang, the East China Sea islands of Diao, the Diaoyu Islands and the Senkaku Islands. Those are red lines. So conceivably, you could get in a conflict if the Seventh Fleet were to engage in things other than freedom of operation exercises, which is what we do now routinely in the region. And with Russia, listen, the Russians don't want to go to war. We have the same number of nuclear weapons as the Russians. We are superior in every other category by far. And Putin loves the pictures of negotiating arms control agreements on the front page of the papers. He likes the United States. He wants to divide us, and he wants to weaken us, but he likes the United States playing a role where he can be seen as engaging with a superpower. He wants to continue doing that. So the hotspots really then become the Persian Gulf, Iran, Hezbollah moving south in Syria toward Israel. That becomes a serious tripwire. And the nuclear powers in the subcontinent, namely Pakistan and India, because you've got border issues that we're reading about even in the north in Kashmir that still are inflamed. And once that happens, boy, you can't put that one back in the box very easily. And that pulls a lot of people in. So these are the basic, these are the real tripwires around the world that could pull us in. We've been at war for 20 years. Nobody wants more war. People want us out of the Middle East. They want an end to, my sons have known nothing but war their entire lives. That's it. And it's like, how crazy is this? You know, $2 trillion, thousands dead, millions of refugees that have been scattered here and there. And so what are we gonna show for it at the end of the day? We have to learn those lessons. They're gonna be hard lessons to learn, but we've gotta learn those lessons and figure out how we can better inform our foreign policy going forward. So I don't think the mood of Congress or even any president, Republican or Democrat, is gonna be in a frame of mind to engage in a war anytime soon. That's why preemptive diplomacy is important, getting back to the value of diplomats. If some of you wanna become diplomats, I highly recommend it. Thank you. Thanks for your future service in advance.
Hello, I'm Ben Robbins. I'm from Idaho.
Whereabouts?
Rexburg, Idaho.
Nice.
Southeast Idaho. I'm studying political science here, and hopefully will be attending law school once I finish my undergrad. I had a question about what you said concerning mental health for especially 18 to 24-year-olds in Utah. In Idaho, I was a juvenile corrections officer, and I saw a lot of the effects of poor mental health, especially among the juvenile population. What is the juvenile justice, juvenile justice system like in Utah, and how is it rehabilitating those youth who find themselves in there, or is it simply punitive? Do we have people pushing for more rehabilitative services in juvenile justice?
You know, that's a long, complicated question, because I think it really goes county by county, region by region, in terms of how that demographic is dealt with. And whether it's drug abuse cases, where we have drug courts in some cases that I think help facilitate some things. But I do think that mental health is a player at a certain age demographic, particularly the one that I cited. And what should we be doing about it as it relates to the state? Well, we need more resources and we need more rural outreach, because I think we have some very vulnerable populations at the younger age demographic in rural areas that have very little access to the resources that those in metropolitan areas would have. Second, I really think that college campuses and this demographic is really one that needs to be the focus of any effort around mental health and preemptive measures to keep people out of juvenile court or drug addiction. And third, you know, something this campus can do very well through health sciences, and that's, what are the root causes driving mental health? Let's get to the bottom of it, like we have with cancer and other human diseases, where you can find at the molecular level, at the genomic level, what triggers behavior, how to turn it on, how to turn it off, how to manipulate it before it manifests itself. I think that's a longer term play, but I think it's also a very, very important one. But I think we're just scratching the surface on the effect that certain issues regarding mental health play in our criminal justice system, even at the juvenile level.
And then that was our last question. So again, thank you, John, if I can still call you that, for being here with us today. And if you'll all join me in thanking him at least one more time.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
If you'd like to hear the full Q&A section or listen to another Hinckley Forum, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org or on the Hinckley Institute podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Way No One's Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.